Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for attending today's session on approach to dental abscesses in rabbits. I think we've got to start out with the basics with these, and it will become clear, I guess, why this is relevant to this discussion here. I mean, basically, we can ignore baby teeth, but we do need to be aware of the adult dentition in terms of incisors, premolars and molars, and what they have. The location of these, of course, is also very relevant indeed. With our incisors, obviously, we know they have long curved roots bringing back through here. They have a large diastema, and then obviously you have your cheek teeth, which we tend to collectively assume all in a row here. And obviously, because all of these teeth continuously grow, we can get infections or abscessation really at any of these tooth roots. Having dental charts are great. I think it's good to try and record things more formally, particularly if you're going to be passing over to somebody else to compare notes subsequently. And I put in here sort of the causes of dental disease here, why they might do this. I think what we've got to think about here is, we're not really going to go into details of staging of dental disease or anything, but I think we do need to be aware here, these cases do have dental disease. So much as we might want to focus on dealing with and sorting out the abscess per se, we equally do need to be thinking about sorting out and dealing with dental pathology as well. And you may have overgrowth of teeth from the other side that are not being having sufficient occlusion, etc., etc., etc. So just step back and think about teeth as a whole here. Don't just focus solely on, okay, it's an abscess, what am I going to do with this abscess? Now, clinically, of course, they're going to present a little bit differently to a dental spur, as we had in the last picture here, where what we're dealing with now is a rabbit coming in with an overt facial swelling. And your facial swelling really, realistically, is going to be over the maxilla or mandible, generally in front of the eye, but we will get some that will track behind the mandible on the inside and can erupt ventrally as well. So realistically, any facial swelling sort of proximal to the ear really would potentially be or most likely be due to a dental abscess. In terms of a diagnosis, I guess, in a consultation room, then an FNA would be okay. A bigger gauge needle will get you more purulent material out. And to be honest, purulent material looks like purulent material when you remove it. So a lot of these are something you can tell, you know, fairly happily with an aspirate in consultation. We do need to get an accurate weight of this patient. It may be this patient has lost weight from previous records, but obviously this isn't going to be needed for fluid therapy, analgesia, and overall monitoring of the effectiveness of your treatment. We need fluid therapy to be on board and in place here with an IV cannula, typically in the marginal ear vein. You may want supportive nutrition here. This animal, if it has lost conditional dehydrated, you may be thinking we're going to need to give it some supportive nutrition before we embark on doing something exciting or investigating this abscess. And obviously we use, you've got products from Supreme, products from Oxbow, products from Lefebvre. All of these are suitably fine to be used as supportive nutrition for these rabbits. Of course, analgesia is critically important for these at this stage. And I think with these sort of cases where you're having an abscess appear in a consult, then this is going to become an inpatient. And realistically, at this stage, we probably would be giving them meloxicam unless we had concerns about their general health. And then we'd be switching on to buprenorphine, ideally parenterally, I guess, for both. Buprenorphine, you might argue, is not sufficiently potent enough for dental osteomyelitis, i.e., osteomyelitis in the bone. I guess you've got to think about practicalities of that. And because we can dose this every 6 to 8 hours versus relying on 4 hours or sometimes more often than that for the pure mu opioids, then buprenorphine probably gives us a reasonable balance between those two while we're working this patient up and working out a plan of what we wish to do. And then you might be thinking, what do I do about antibiotics here? What difference are antibiotics going to make to this patient? Now, I guess if you've got a clear indication of significant infection, the owners are concerned, you're not going to be booking in surgery today, then maybe I need to reach for some antibiotics for that. I'm going to want aerobes and anaerobes to be covered in here, so it's important to realize that enrofloxacin, for example, does not cover anaerobes full stop. And then the next thing you've got is, am I likely to want to take a culture from this? And I guess I'm perhaps lucky with the caseload we have at Edinburgh, and equally maybe my attitude has changed a little bit in that if you're going to be subjecting this animal through a clinical procedure, let's put it that way, a surgical procedure perhaps for these, you're going to be giving yourself an estimate for that surgical procedure. And what tends to happen now is I tend to be offering an estimate for that procedure that by default includes a culture. So if this is going to cost you X amount of money, that includes a culture price for that, and that's what it is. And not doing the culture doesn't change the estimate that you get, it just means you don't do the culture, your price is the same. And for me, that's probably something that's very relevant in here, is I just quote the price and say, okay, it's going to be approximately 15 minutes of surgery on your estimate. We're going to send a swab up. It's going to be about £600, whatever it's going to be. And you've just got to build it in such a way that say, look, this is how it works. It's that same sort of thing. If I'm going to do surgery on rabbits, I have to anaesthetize it. I can't not anaesthetize it. That's part of my estimate. And I strongly believe that cultures in these cases should be as well. We've got to think about poor motility in these. So ranitidine is one that we would use as standard for these. It may be you're using things like cisapride or metoclopramide as well, depending on what you want. But ranitidine would be, I guess, our first line for prokinetics at 4 mg/kg for these. And you can give it parenterally, you can get injectable as well as the oral as well, of course. And if you're giving non-steroidals and you're worried about GI ulceration, then maybe that's a positive effect because of the H2 blocker alongside that. I suppose our question is, well, why do they get an abscess? How is this all forming in the first place? And obviously, we've got infection here. We've got purulent material within this, which again, you can aspirate on your FNA. But generally, this is dead center contents of this abscess. The capsule around the edge of this is the bit that is the active interface between the infection and the body. And obviously, as the infection continues, the abscess swells. And in the case of rabbits, where you're getting very solid material, then it becomes trapped within this abscess capsule. And some of these can be perfectly healthy, where they've warded it all off and the animal couldn't care less. And okay, in dogs and cats, it's liquid, so we can try and drain that. But in the rabbits, because it is solid and then their neutrophils cannot liquefy the debris, then it kind of pushes them into a surgical case. When you're evaluating an abscess, it's important to work out where it is and what it's come from. And the point to make here is if you've got bone involvement in this abscess, you will not be able to move it. It will be fixed to the bone of the mandible or the maxilla. Whereas if it's soft tissue, you'll be able to mobilize that quite nicely. And it's being perfectly honest, is giving them antibiotics to this alone is not going to make any real difference here. You need physical removal, to be honest, to deal with this. So there is a very sound argument in just not don't waste your time giving antibiotics, waiting for surgery to happen. If you're going to do some imaging, then obviously radiography is something you can consider doing, and it will help you plan your procedure far better. It's a question of how many views you want to take. There's up to seven that you could take here. Difficult to take intraoral radiographs for these. I would say probably the most useful would be to skyline, do an oblique projection here to skyline the swelling that you're feeling to try and work out which tooth roots are involved. To get these, you're going to realistically need some sedation. And I suppose the question you've got now is, what am I planning on doing today? Because if I'm planning on sedating my rabbit, getting radiographs from my rabbit, reviewing those radiographs, and then I'm going to phone the owner and have a chat about the range of options, whether this is a viable case, how we're going to approach this case, then obviously I'm thinking about I'm going to sedate you just for radiography versus a what I want to do is anaesthetize you, take my radiographs, and then if it's deemed appropriate, progress forward straight afterwards onto doing some sort of surgical intervention. And that really is a question of how you have worded that to the owners in terms of the planning and your scheduling for the day in terms of which way you're going to do it. At the minute, I suppose I'm going down the route of let's sedate, x-ray, wake up, pause and reflect, and then make a plan next. And for these, midazolam, ketamine are very nice, will give you the amount of sedation that you need. Not a lot of analgesia, mind you, but enough that you can get your nice images. And again, there's nothing wrong with using medetomidine and ketamine. It's just if you think your patient is compromised, then this may be of concern. And like I say, I've got dorsiventral here, lateral radiographs here, but your skyline is probably the best. And we're looking at an abscess, saying, okay, great, here is our abscess here, we've got bone remodeling here, here's a soft tissue element all the way around here. And now what I'm looking at, because I've worked out there's going to be five cheek teeth here, I've got one, two, three. But certainly, premolar one and two in this case here are obviously involved in the abscess in this particular case here. What I would encourage you to do if you are in a position to is CT them. This is something we do conscious, gives you far more detail than you're ever going to get out of imaging. We can run contrast through this. So the actual economics of running a conscious CT is, to be honest, the same, if not less, than a sedated or anaesthetized series of radiographs. Allows us to plan properly. We can show the owner everything in detail. And then obviously, surgery is planned on another day where we're going to anaesthetize you for surgery. What I would encourage you to do is to autoclave your dental kit. You tend to find with these that you suddenly find that the use of elevators and things like that are something you're going to suddenly want during this process. And like I say, having a sterilized dental kit ready for you to use for surgery is quite important. So if we're going to go in surgically for these, once we've worked out which teeth are involved, then you're going to have an anaesthetic and we're going to need plenty of analgesia around for that. And we want to try and get our analgesia to be multimodal, really. And I would say that local nerve blocks are kind of essential for these here. And really, it's a question then of what we think is involved tooth-wise for that. Lidocaine is great. It acts quite quickly, but short duration. Your Marcaine takes a little bit longer to kick in, but of a longer duration. But these are two very, very useful agents I'd have. These you're going to be putting into place, I guess, under anesthesia for them versus doing it when they are awake. Morphine is also commonly used. It's pure mu, high-level analgesia. You can get sedation at the higher doses, same as you can do with methadone, but you've got to dose every 4 hours. So if you're planning that today is going to be the day of my surgery, then obviously I don't want to put buprenorphine on board at 8 o'clock. That's going to mess up my opportunity to be giving myself some morphine later. So if today is the day of surgery, then your dosing at 8 o'clock in the morning needs to be the start of your morphine, because today is the day you're going to be going under anaesthetic. And like I say, methadone we use up to sort of half a mg per kg every 4 hours. We do get sedative effects as well. And maybe there's less side effects in terms of dysphoria and hyperalgesia and things you get maybe with your morphine. The downside of dosing intermittently like this is you do run out of agent really at the end of those periods. You've got peaks and troughs in the level of analgesia. And a continuous rate infusion is the way forward to enable you to eliminate that, to even out the serum levels to provide analgesia longer term. And we'll certainly be looking at using low dose ketamine, dexmedetomidine in our continuous rate infusions alongside an opioid of our choice to maintain analgesia for that patient. And I basically have created some charts at work to make life very easy. Your loading dose of things like methadone, for example, or dexmedetomidine are going to be based on mgs per kg for that patient. But if you're going to start running fluids on a syringe driver at a set rate of, say, 10 mils per kilo per hour, then realistically you're moving on to a ratio, and that really can make life quite easy for dosing subsequently. So basically, in these cases, if you said we're going to go for a ketamine, dexmedetomidine, and methadone CRI, if we take these and we mix basically in the ratio we've got here, 0.4, 0.2, and 0.4, we mix them together in a 1 mL syringe, and then we add 0.05 mils of that to every 20 mils of fluid we're going to give. If that's dosed then at 10 mils per kilo per hour, that ratio will work for every patient. I've just made it simple. And then basically, you run this CRI for as long as possible during that process. And obviously, having set up the CRI and started it running, then we may be looking then at wanting to intubate this rabbit. Of course, we will do. We're expecting to potentially make a hole through into the oral cavity, so we're going to expect blood or pus or lavage fluids maybe to drain into the oral cavity. There's a risk of aspiration here, so we do need a secure airway with an ET tube. And obviously, bearing in mind at some point you're going to have to look in the mouth as well. And sometimes with these, we end up doing a bit of a push me pull me, where we're doing maybe a ventral or lateral approach to an abscess, but also equally, it maybe we're going orally to remove teeth as well, depending on the nature and you know what signs we've got here. At this point, of course, I wouldn't be giving antibiotics at this stage. I will be wanting to physically remove the entire abscess, and you know try and minimize damage to everything else before I start putting antibiotics on board. But of course, because these involve bone, it is absolutely impossible to eliminate infection completely. But obviously, the starting point here is let's go and do a soft tissue dissection down to bone around the abscess capsule. I think it's worth just mentioning here where our tooth roots go, as this gives you a very good guide as to where your dental abscesses might occur if you're looking at the cheek teeth. On the incisors, obviously, they're very rostral, and you generally can feel those right at the base, and they're fairly obvious. But for the cheek teeth, you've really got a couple of three options for them. If it's premolar 1 and 2, they tend to form abscesses in front of the zygomatic arch, and you'll get a swelling just in front of the eye here, which then means your surgical approach can come in laterally at this point to those. If you're getting premolar 3 or molar 1, 2, or 3, these then tend to be forming an abscess at the back of the orbit here, so they're retrobulbar. So you get your retrobulbar abscess, and obviously these are further back. If you want to try and blockade these out, then basically you need to do a maxillary nerve block, and for these, you're bringing your needle in ventral to the eye, coming down to the base here to try and get the maxillary nerve there to block these out, which can be quite difficult. If we're on the lower mandible, then obviously these are your roots here, and these four would generally burst out ventrally here. And again, you can block these out with a mandibular nerve block, which runs between the vertical and horizontal ramus, and you pass your needle medial to the mandible to block out the mandibular nerve to block these out. For your last one here, this can be quite annoying in that it can burst out laterally over the mandible, which then means you get a soft tissue swelling underneath the massator muscle, or it can burst out medially to the mandible, and then you may have a swelling and discharge coming down here medial to that. So some of these will have a complete perforation, the hole in that bone, it would just be destroyed by the infection too. So knowing where these will be and where your abscesses are going to form will help you plan your surgical approach. Same picture here, but just going through the where the lower cheek teeth will cause the abscesses I've been through in the last image. But this is kind of even in the absence of doing imaging, let's suggest you're on a financial budget, the location of this abscess should give you a very good guide as to which teeth are involved. And to some extent, then you just go down and see how deep the rabbit hole goes, as it were. You don't necessarily have to have CT or imaging planning if you're on a budget. But the first thing you want to do with these is get rid of your soft tissue. That's the first step in your dissection. We need to dissect around this abscess capsule all the way round down to bone. We're trying to make this as sterile as we can do, if that makes sense, at this stage of the game, at the very least. But the aim really is to dissect all your way around. Think about cautery in terms of vessels as well. What you find with these, and this is where I will be slightly cautious of putting needles into these, repetitively lanced and drained and flushed and done sort of palliative care, you can get seeding and tracking of that infection right the way through all of the subcutaneous tissue. So you can end up having to be quite extensive at your removal of soft tissue if you're trying to go in definitively surgically after having taken the route of palliative care, stabbing and lancing and flushing a number of times beforehand. It makes the surgery harder because you've got infectious tracts all over the place versus it being nicely contained as we've got in this image here. But once you start working your way down to bone, you reach the point that I've now got to do something now. And for me, it's a bit like a Tunnock's tea cake where you've can dissect around, but at some point you hit the biscuit base, which is where you're up to here, and you've got to take the marshmallow off the top. And at that point, basically, you now are going to end up opening the area, you're going to start infection being present in here, you're going to have contaminated it by entering into the abscess, and that's inevitable. What you've got at this point, I guess, is you've got samples that you can then do something with. But now we're going to take away all the we're going to flush and clean, empty this site out, and all of this remodeled bone that's spiky and awkward and painful diseased we're going to be getting rid of to try and create a new jawline that's flat. I would encourage you to give your abscess to somebody else, and we want culture and cytology from this site. But what we want is the abscess capsule. So we want the interface between infection and the body, i.e., this bit. We don't want to be taking a culture swab just to pass. That's not going to give us the ideal. We need this sort of tissue here. We need a tissue biopsy to go into your charcoal swab here for culture. And that needs to go for aerobes, anaerobes, and fungal. Okay, anaerobic infections here are quite significant. And at this point, you could then say, okay, I'm going to give you some antibiotics now. Now I've done that, I've got my culture, I'm going to start you on antibiotics because I've had to expose this site now. I'm risking infection creeping into the subcutaneous tissues, and now I'm going to reach my antibiotics. And I guess IV antibiotics is your way forward. If you can do it perisurgically, we're quite limited on our options available here. You could consider using enrofloxacin or metronidazole IV. Difficult to get IV sulfonamide preps these days to use. And you may also be considering using products such as penicillin parenterally to these alongside IV therapy, in the perisurgical period. What you're going to need next, of course, is this autoclaved dental kit that you got hold of. Because if you've got tooth roots down here, and hopefully you've had the opportunity to plan or think about which tooth roots are involved, you've now got to look at extracting teeth via your incision. Or, like I say, it may be per os, but either way, these teeth have to come out. So, using your molar luxators or elevators, along with the molar grasping forceps, are going to facilitate you getting these out. Bearing in mind, you're going to be expecting this to be making a hole directly through into the mouth now, as you remove this tooth. You're going to expect that. But if we can go in and get rid of these teeth that are involved, critically evaluate the surgical site as you're doing it, as you're going through. Make sure every tooth you think is relevant is removed from here, and that all necrotic and unpleasant looking bone, as much as is humanly possible, is removed. And I think we have to be aware with these when we're going through removing material that you're going to have to be quite extensive to try and eliminate all of the infection from these. And you may reach the point through that progression that you feel happy that primary closure is an acceptable next step to take. You do have to be aware that they've got bone down here that is very thin. You will create pathological fractures as a consequence, or iatrogenic fractures as a consequence of your surgery. I think the thing is, to some extent, is get on with it. If you fracture the jaw, you fracture the jaw. It's part of what is necessary. Most rabbits cope incredibly well with jaw fractures. Two reasons, really, I guess, that I would put into that category. The first one is their mandibular symphysis is quite broad and stable. The joining between these two incisor roots tends to hold that frog fragment pretty firmly. And at the back bit, they've got a very large massator muscle that tends to hold it together. So it's not like you're dealing with a cat with two sides wibbling in the wind. This tends to be relatively well held together. And I think, to be honest, it's a necessary part of effectively removing the infection from these sites. And obviously, suturing the wound, we would tend to then be, after we cleaned and flushed, maybe something along the lines of monocryl, something monofilament. It's not going to have any wicking, not any tissue irritation, and aim for primary closure. I suppose the question is, do you want to close this wound? A lot of people don't like the idea of closing them. They'd rather they were left open and you packed or filled them. This allows you to flush the site repeatedly. If you're going to go down this route, make sure you've got a secure airway, of course. And some people would flush them with antibiotics, antiseptics, things like that. And if you are going to go down that route, please make sure that you do flush them out and think about how much contact time they need to have an effect as well. Some of the things we might do in exotics, which I guess are maybe different to some of the approaches undertaken in dog and cat or human medicine these days, would be to consider local therapy. And these are cases where maybe you're thinking, I do have significant osteomyelitis. I'm not happy that my surgical approach has eliminated enough infection for me to close this wound without trying to do something in addition to systemic antibiotics. The good thing, if you're going to put something locally in, is because you're putting it in the center of an abscess area, then the systemic effect of that is quite limited. So you can actually then start using other agents that maybe you would be apprehensive or reluctant to use systemically. So it might be something like you want to use gentamicin here or something, or clindamycin, whereas that obviously would be something that you would not wish to put systemically in a rabbit for fear of dysbiosis. And we do make up polymethyl methacrylate beads. I think they have probably largely fallen out of favor these days, to be honest. There's lots of studies looking at other infections and other species that you want meticulous surgery to eliminate all your infection and be thorough with your flushing and cleaning. And if your surgery is done to the best of your ability, then the addition of topical treatments and drains and stuff like that doesn't really enhance the success rate. It's that first chance surgery and doing the best job that you can with that that's going to have an impact on the prognosis and outcome of your cases far more than anything you might like to shove or stick in the wound. But if you are going to make beads, you're making a polymethyl methacrylate up. We tend to use a human bone cement, which contains gentamicin. We add clindamycin powder to that, such we're getting an increased spectrum of cover, including the anaerobes, of course. And then having made them up, you can then basically instill them into your wound and then continue with your primary closure as you would like. But if you do decide you want to leave them open so you can put topical treatment in, then we've got to think about what am I hoping that my topical treatment is going to achieve. And that's quite an important thing. A lot of people get this wrong. What we want to do here is to have a local bacterial kill effect. Fair enough. We want it to aid in debridement of necrotic tissue from the wound. That's also great, which means you're less debris, quicker healing. We need it to keep the wound moist, because what I want to do is to get leukocytes coming in here. We want to speed up granulation tissue to facilitate healing. So these are the main sort of principles that I need. Now, if you're very old like me, then you'll think back to what people used to use for wounds, and people used to get antirobe capsules at the time. You make holes into your capsule with needles, and you just pop this into your abscess cavity, and it would slowly decompose in there and probably inflame and annoy local tissue as well. Some very old people may remember using hydrogen peroxide, which you'd use to disinfect wounds. Concern here, of course, it is gas embolism from oxygen formation. But obviously, hydrogen peroxide, antirobe, these can all lead to scarring and slow healing because these are going to damage the reparative processes going on at that point. And what you really want is just a low concentration of hydrogen peroxide to try and induce healing. You don't want the sort of concentrations you're getting from the flushes. And then you look at what other things you could consider sticking into the wound. And people will use a lot of flamazine, tamadine, all these sorts of things into them. And what you've got to be aware of, if I'm putting a disinfectant into there or something like that, I'm probably going to be toxic to my white cells. I'm probably going to create a foreign body maybe in that wound that's going to impair healing as well. So all of these sorts of things that I would not be putting anywhere near an open wound of any sort in any species, really. Topical for surface on healed skin maybe, but for open wounds, really you're asking these to cause an ongoing issue. And I think there's a difference here between physical debridement at the start and then a disinfectant rinse or wash through for a local bacterial kill effect maybe, followed by thorough rinsing of the product out so you're not going to inflame the tissue subsequently or impair healing, and then moving on to a different agent versus using your flamazine cream or an iodine-based, iodophore-based sort of cleaning product on a daily basis to clean this wound, where every day you're just going to impair healing because of your agents you're using. And the things you should be looking at really, I think, is moving more towards the hydrogels, which are great. These obviously are mostly water, but in a gel base. This encourages hydration of that wound. Due to an osmotic effect, it draws in fluid, neovascularization and leukocytes as well, and obviously has an eye, reduces the risk of wound infection and a local bacterial kill effect, but without damaging the healing process. And hydrocolloids also form part of this, so things like Allevyn or Granuflex, these in many cases will be used in wounds to cover over the hydrogels that you put in place to again facilitate debridement and removal of the top layer of necrotic tissue. And you obviously can leave these in place for up to 5 days, but they're really good for cleaning and assisting wounds to granulate, which, like I say, a sort of a middle ground exudate, really. Honey, of course, is another big one that's used a lot in the exotics. And basically, it's got lots of activities. I suppose I try and think of these to some extent as a bit like a hydrocolloid, a hydrogel, but they have a lot of additional properties as well that speed along healing. They're quite acidic, which of course can also help prevent bacterial growth. But they do have the osmolarity effect of drawing fluid into the wound bed, enabling lymphocyte chemotaxis and things as well. It does have antibacterial activity, and different honeys have different potencies. The vast majority of honeys actually mediate some of their antibacterial effect by hydrogen peroxides, peroxide, which is quite nice. But in Manuka honey, there is an additional factors in here called the unique Manuka factor, which adds into the anterior bacterial activity over and above a routine honey. And there are also some evidence out there that exists that support honey is stimulating their immune response, suppressing inflammation, etc., etc. There's a whole load of anecdotal changes as well. But I think for me, it's the same as a hydrogel with increased bacterial kill, and maybe facilitating increased repair, but that again is equivocal. The medical grade Manuka honey you can get obviously is sterile, so that's good. We need to be cautious of encouraging bacterial growth in shop-bought honey. And obviously, you need quite a high concentration of the honey to get the desired effect that you want. So I think in these, if you're going to go down the route of honey, then I would be encouraging you to utilize medical grade on every occasion that you can do, despite this being a more expensive alternative. And what you're really looking at for these is you've created the cavity where you've removed all the infection out. You've gone in and you've taken the infective teeth out. You're left with a cavity, and this is the cavity that I'm going to be filling with my topical or local therapy. And Obviously, as time progresses, what you're looking for is you want to see this granulating and healing and starting to fill in as the infection clears. And it may be this is being flushed on a daily basis. I would just use saline. I literally just flush with saline to flush things through and then repack with your Intracyte or with your honey subsequently to that. And obviously, over time, the aim is that the big hole starts contracting down and we start getting healing forming in that case. And as time goes by, then hopefully the swelling will start to settle. Post-surgery, we will be looking really to continue the continuous rate infusion as long as we possibly can do. And I suppose practically, pragmatically thinking what is practical for these is we probably would be keeping these patients on pure mu opioids until 12 o'clock. What I would say is if you've got a CRI running with methadone or morphine, and then you stop your CRI, if you give them a full dose of methadone or morphine at that point, immediately following your CRI, you do risk having some sedation, sometimes some marked sedation from your pure mu opioid. It may be that first dose you want to lower it down. It may be you decide to delay giving that dose for 1 or 2 hours before following up from your CRI. We do use a lot of tramadol. Effectiveness obviously is equivocal, but we nevertheless will do. Meloxicam for a week, 10 days post-surgery as well. Obviously, your local will have worn off, your CRI would have worn off. And again, think about your prokinetics as well with that. If you're wanting to give oral analgesia, I'm afraid that both oral buprenorphine and oral tramadol are equivocal. I'm not convinced either of them work very effectively. So for me, for these patients, I'm hospitalizing on pure mu opioids followed by buprenorphine until I am happy that they don't need parenteral analgesia anymore. And then if the buprenorphine tramadol gives some but not as effective as we'd like, I'm not worried because you've had 3 days worth, probably 3 days worth of mu opioid before I switched you on to oral therapy. Antibiotic treatment for these, I think probably we're looking at a month to 6 weeks of antibiotic therapy for these cases. And again, depends on whether you want to choose oral or parenteral, and that's the practicalities of the case that you're dealing with. I think if you're unlucky and you get recurrence coming back, then obviously imaging at this point, you do again to review the case. You'd have them off antibiotic treatment, repeat culture prior to you doing something, because here you might want to switch antibiotics before you start. And generally for these, if I've done it once to the best of my ability and I've left it closed and it's come back, then the second time I tend to go, you know what, I'm going to leave you open and treat you topically now. It's very rare that I would close a case on the second occasion, having the first occasion failed. And that's just personal choice. If you've got multi-resistant pathogens here, okay, your options might be quite limited because we've got animals here that will suffer from dysbiosis. Your oral ranges might be quite limited. You may have a slightly more options available to you parenterally. So review your culture result. Make sure the lab is testing products you can actually give to this rabbit. Cephalexin you can give parenterally. Ceftaz, ticosylin, you might get away with that IV. You'd just be cautious of that. Things like aminoglycosides, you probably get away with IV as well. But if you don't have any antibiotics you can use, then you may have to resort to using something topical with the wound that's left open. And for some of these, we've had historically animals with multi-resistant Pseudomonas that we've just got away with honey. We've just literally opened everything out, cleaned it, flushed it, and used honey repeatedly on these wounds. Bearing in mind we've debrided all the bone that we can do, they've had a surgical intervention to eliminate as much as possible, and then you're mopping up what's left with honey. And we have had some of these that we've been able to manage, and I guess it's more manage than cure, with honey for quite some time scale. And just bear in mind, like I say, a little splash of iodine here and there, it's not really going to have the effect that you want in terms of controlling this, but it may impair the ability of the animal to heal. And so we do have to be aware that we want to be sensible when we're choosing how to manage these. And like I say, if you look at things like Pseudomonas, which we do see in some of these, for example, then you can get it. You can isolate Pseudomonas from the iodine, chlorhexidine, and all sorts of solutions that you might be squirting in here. So you may be in the situation that you're failing to kill off the bug you want, but what you are doing is preventing the animal from having an adequate ability to fight the infection itself. And then we sort of come on to this is just a final thing here, and again, this is very old school. Those of you treating Pseudomonas in dog's ears will remember that you'd go to the local shop and get clear vinegar for treatment of Pseudomonas, and there is some logic in that. And citric acid, ascorbic acid, acetic acid, has been used for topical treatment in the human field as well as in the veterinary field. And this may be something you've got to consider when you get to that point. But I think at the minute, we tend to be more tending towards honey than maybe some of these older school sort of remedies. We do have a couple of questions coming in from today's webinar. And the first one is what would be my recommended analgesia for these patients? And I think for me, it's if I was planning analgesia for them, first thing I would do is probably give them oral non-steroidals before I started. I would then tend to have some. I use a CRI. I would go for probably methadone in preference these days with dexmedetomidine and ketamine as a CRI. But what I might do before that is I might sedate with a little bit of midazolam, just to take the edge off them, anxiolytic, that sort of type thing. Load the CRI in place, then I would be inducing with something like Alfaxan for them. At that point, I would go for nerve blocks. I would be doing maxillary, mandibular, mentor, or proximal maxillary, depending on whether it was incisor tooth roots or cheek tooth roots you were dealing with. But I certainly would put a local blockade in there with lidocaine, bupivacaine. I would then continue on the CRI as long as possible. In recovery, when the CRI had to stop, I'd follow with mu opioids until midnight, probably, sometimes overnight, but generally midnight to be practical. At midnight, I would switch on to buprenorphine. And I guess, it's in the evening when your bupivacaine is going to start wearing off. So you just have to be aware that that's going to start wearing off too. And then basically continue with buprenorphine for probably 48 hours, switch on to tramadol, keep the oral non-steroidals going for a week, 10 days. And that's probably the analgesia that'll be running through for most of these cases. Second question that's come through is, what would be my preferred antibiotic regimen for these cases or things like that? So I suppose the question there really is I haven't been able to take a culture, or I'm waiting for my culture results to come back, or I've taken a culture but I've grown nothing. What would I'd be recommending you use in those circumstances? And I think there's a few drugs that we have on our list that we would go to as a, I guess, a first line. Now, I guess it's whether this is first line or second line here, because we know we've got significant infection present. We know aerobes and anaerobes, sometimes with multi-resistance, will be involved. So there is an element here of maybe choosing higher level antibiotics as a first line because I've got significant bone infection here. So our first line choice of antibiotics for rabbits generally would be something along the lines of Solfotrim, TMPS. Now that's okay. Not very good at getting into infective purulent sites. Does gram positives, does gram negatives, does anaerobes. But I think in the presence of significant infection, maybe a sulfonamide-trimethoprim combination is not good enough. What I then would be looking at doing for these cases is probably I would go for enrofloxacin IV at the time of surgery, simply because it's an IV product. I can get away with that IV. But very mindful that that has no anaerobic cover whatsoever. Good against gram positives and negatives, good against resistance, no activity against anaerobes, and maybe would have difficulty getting into that site. And then I'd need to be complementing that enrofloxacin with something else. In those cases, it might be I start adding in some penicillin, which we can give parenterally, subcutaneously at the time of surgery. And if my owner was happy then to continue with that, they could continue penicillin at home. Maybe we'll switch to oral enrofloxacin alongside it, or maybe we'll just drop the oral enrofloxacin and just leave the penicillin for at home to try and keep things simple. Bearing in mind, we probably would have had 4 days of enrofloxacin whilst in the clinic with us before it went home. Your other option here is metronidazole, and metronidazole is lovely in that it's very, very good against anaerobes, but only anaerobes. But it will get into purulent infective areas as well. So some of these will have on to injectable metronidazole perisurgically, which works very well, and then maybe we'll switch them on to oral metronidazole as they go home. And I think those practically are the ones I'd be choosing here in preference to a sulfonamide, given the sort of infection that we're dealing with here. And like I say, if you have resistance issues, then some of these will be switching on to things like cephalexin. But again, if you're getting resistance to penicillins, this is another cell wall. So maybe you get resistance to cephalexin at the same time. Higher grade fluoroquinolones is not really much use to you there. Your aminoglycosides will be a bit off to the side and a different mode of action. They might be useful for you to try. Or maybe something like azithromycin would be an alternative for these as well. And ideally base these on culture, but you've got probably 3 or 4 classes before you start running out. And then if you're using topical treatment, if you're leaving these open, for example, then for me, I'd be using honey all the way through as my first and last choice topical therapy there for them. So that's the end of the questions that I had as well from today. I'm now going to pass you back to Eimear.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and a certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.